Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, Andrew Frankel, my co-host, and a very special guest this week. On our screens there, Mr. Mike Brewer. Hello, Mike. Thanks for coming.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, Mike, everyone watching this or listening to this, I'm pretty sure, is going to know who you are. How long have you been on our TV screens? I think it's more than 25 years.
It's 27 years, actually. Yeah, 1997. I did this little show on Channel 4 called Deals on Wheels, which was a big success for Channel 4. I thought it was a bit of a laugh when I first did it, and here I am 27 years later and talking to you.
Yeah, blimey.
So how did it all begin for you? I mean, would you call yourself these days a car trader, a television presenter? What are you at your heart?
I'm still a car trader at heart. I still have my car garages. I've got Mike Brewer Motors up in Sheffield and One Automotive in Warwickshire, and if I'm not buying or selling cars on TV or talking about cars on television, you'll find me down at my car sites selling cars to members of the public.
You and do still do that. You do still do deals, sell cars. That's great.
My business partner took a week off last week. I turned up and sold 16 cars on Monday and Tuesday. I had the best time ever. It was brilliant.
Yeah, fantastic. Oh, maybe we need to go and buy a car off Mike. That would be a story, wouldn't it?
I did.
Yes, you did. No, I did. We'll save that.
And it's still in my shed.
he has been one of my customers.
Yeah, save that. We'll come to that. Mike, let's talk about Wheeler Dealers, because that's what you're best known for. That's been on our screens for 20 years or so. Almost 300 episodes. Presumably that wasn't in the plan way back when you started this show.
No, when we first came up with the show, that was back in 2002, we sat down and wrote it out on a piece of paper, me and another couple of other guys, and Mike and Dan, they're amazing. And we sat down and sort of devised this show over lunch. It was already a plan. It was an item that I'd done previously on Deals on Wheels, and it was to expand that item. So it was already a plan to buy it, fix up, restore, and sell a car. But we just fleshed it out a little bit more. And I'll be honest with you, when I made the first few episodes, it wasn't my kind of thing. I'd just come off the back of a big Channel 4 contract with making Driven on Channel 4 with Jason Plato and Penny Mallory, and a huge crew, you know, amazing budgets and, you know, helicopters and Jimmy Jibs and all of that kind of stuff to go and film this car show with a guy with a small little handheld camera. And and I thought, I'm not too sure this is what I want to do anymore. But we did the first series and it went out. And when it went out, I got inundated with people saying, we just love that show. You know, we thought it was amazing. It rated the highest rated show, I think, on that network at the time. And they asked for another series. And I thought maybe there's two or three series in it that would do.
Yeah.
But here we are, into our 21st year.
Blimey.
And it's getting bigger and better than ever.
I mean, I think it's really unlikely that anybody listening to this doesn't know Wheeler Dealers, but someone might. So could you just talk us through the format. What's the idea? So what have you go out and you find a car? Who decides what that car's going to be? Is that your call or?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I'm a car dealer, so it's my job to know what's going to buy and sell. That's the word of a wheeler dealer. So it's to be canny in the marketplace and try and work out the best deals and know that you're going to buy something that's going to be iconic enough that it's going to remote somebody to buy at the end of the at the end of the program. So I, in the very early days, would sit with the producers and we'd come up with lists of cars that we wanted to do. And back then it was, you know, Porsche. We only had a small budget. So it was, I think the first episode was a Porsche 924 and then a little Mark 1 Mini, which you could buy back then for £300. So we come up with some iconic cars that people would recognise and emote to and love. And my job is to go out there and buy the car, hand it over to my mechanic, get my mechanic to do the fixes up that I've noticed when I bought it, make sure that all the fixes are done correctly by taking it for this lovely test drive at the end. In the meantime, I would run off and go and buy parts for the car. The mechanic could do the work. Then we'd take it for a test drive at the end, and hopefully we'd sell it on to somebody that loved it enough to give us a profit.
It's a great format, isn't it? And actually, one of the brilliant things about the show is that you're doing what so many of us would love to go and do, buy a tired old car that has potential, fix it up, realize that potential and turn a profit. Lots of us would love to do that, but we don't have the time or the wherewithal or the skills or the workshop or whatever, so we get to do it through you and your mechanic. It's fantastic.
Yes, and it's the I'm rather proud of the fact that although now there's hundreds of shows doing the same thing, they can all sort of trace their history back to that original Wheel of Dealers.
So were you the first of those sorts of car restoration programs?
Yeah, it's the first ever flipping car show on the planet. Yeah. There was no other. Nothing come after it for a few years.
And is it now that Top Gear is sadly no longer on our screens? Is it now the longest running car show on TV? It can't be far off.
Yeah, Discovery and Warner Brothers will tell you not only is it the largest car show on the planet, but it's also the longest running car show in the world as well. So,
wow.
And it's the most. I think it's the most watched program for Discovery Channel globally. It's their most watched program around the world.
Okay, so can I tell you what I think makes it work, and then you can tell me why I'm wrong? I think it works because it's, on one level, it's a very objective thing. It's about making some money. It's about buying a product. It's about preparing that product for resale and then getting rid of it. But on a whole other layer, there is an emotional connection. Then we see these cars, and even if they're the sorts of cars that we'd never think of buying ourselves, if you like cars at all, you just love the idea of old cars and someone taking the care and the time and the attention to bring them back to life. And you just want it to be a happy story where everyone, you know, ends up winning. Is that somewhere near the mark?
I think that's exactly near the mark, Andrew. I also think there's another element to it. It's a bit like why these gold programs work, people digging for gold and diamonds. I think that people want to get to the end to see if there is a profit to be made out of the car. Does Mike go and find that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow? So there's loads of elements to it. I think the main draw for the show, for the audience that I've seen over the last 21 years, through meeting them, talking to them on social media, is they love the mechanics. They love the engineering.
Yeah.
They love the fact that we bear down into it and we get into the minutiae of what makes a car tick. And fundamentally, if you think, as you say, we've done nearly 300 shows, we have showed you backwards, forwards, up, down, left, right, inside and out, how to fix, restore a car. And we're still coming up with new ideas and new ways to show you in the next episode and the next episode.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's got a few tricks to it, Wheeler Dealers. And most definitely what you said is right. It's a very emotive thing for people wanting to buy, fix up and sell cars.
Let's talk a bit about the sort of mechanics and the engineering side, because it is the depth that the mechanics go into is phenomenal. It's not a sort of light touch thing, you know, just barely scratching the surface. They really go deep. I was watching one with Mark Elvis Priestley. You bought a very tired old Caterham 7 and turned it into a beautiful looking sort of track ready car. And for, you know, there's several minutes of Elvis talking about how you design a custom exhaust for this car. and how you get the length of the headers just right. And it's honestly the nerdiness, the geekiness of that segment and plenty of other segments like it throughout the show. It's just phenomenal, and it's unusual to get that kind of depth around cars and mechanics on television today. I think that's got to be, as you say, a huge part of the draw of the show.
Well, I've been fortunate enough to work with some amazing mechanics on the show over the years, both with Ed China and Tansted, and now with Elvis, that they really care. You know, when we are talking about something on the show, I produce the program these days. And when we sit down and we discuss how the show's going to look and feel, and we're talking about, you know, the headers on a Caterham 7, we really care. And it's nice to, I work with co-presenters that really want to get it right. You know, we know we're up for criticism everywhere. If somebody sees it and it's wrong, they're going to tell us it's wrong. So there's a lot of time, a lot of discussion, a lot of thought goes into each and every segment of the show to make sure that we nail it. You know, we get it right and we educate along the way and have fun whilst we're doing it. And I'm very fortunate to work with some great people that put that together.
How did you go about fighting? It strikes me as being a slightly strange skill set that you have to be a gifted mechanic with an enormous amount of knowledge, but also be really good in front of a television camera. That doesn't strike me as being a sort of two natural things that go together. And yet I think all three, it is three, isn't it? It's Ed and it's Anne and it's Elvis. They're all different, but they can all do it. I mean, presumably there's a fairly long and tortuous process you have to go through to have found each one.
With Ed, we were incredibly lucky. I'd seen Ed actually appear on an episode of Top Gear way back in 2002, where he did a Bond car on a budget. I said, let's get that guy, you know. I knew the moment I met him, he was this engineering marvel. He was making this weird and wacky furniture that drove down the road. He was incredibly talented, and Ed would be the first one to tell you he was absolutely useless on camera. and he'd be the first one to tell you that. But we spent some time together, and we tried and we tested and we tried and we tested, and slowly but surely the confidence builds. And I managed to talk to my mechanics and get them to engage with the camera just like it's their mum. You know, explain it to that camera, that thing that the man's holding there. Remember, that's your mum, and you're just going to talk to your mum and explain to her how this car works. And slowly but surely, Ed got it. He got it very quickly. And then by the time we get round to Anstead, we're 13 years later, had watched, you know, not only Ed, but he'd watched the Hammond, Clarkson, May, he'd watched all the other car shows, you know, whether it's Overhauling or whether it's, Pimp My Ride. He'd watched these other shows by the time he gets round to working with Ant. So he's already got the skill set to be a presenter because he wants to be a presenter and he's already a master mechanic. So I was very fortunate. And with Elvis, he's another, he's an enigma, that guy, because he had 10 years at Formula One with McLaren, leading the team. And then once he went finished leading the team, he went into broadcasting, talking about Formula One. And he's an orator. He goes around the world talking still now. He's probably doing it today. He'll be somewhere in the world talking, doing these presentations like TED Talks about the world of Formula One. So he's really used to presenting, but also an amazing mechanic. So I ended up with these three guys that end up being not only amazing, incredible mechanics, but great communicators. But we spend a lot of time, you know, me and the mechanics and the producers and the directors spend a lot of time making sure that those bits that you see on screen, we think about them and we make sure that we're saying the right thing at the right time. And, it's not just out your head. You don't just come up with it out your head. You have to think it through and make sure that everyone understands it. But I've worked with some great guys.
What's the plan for the show, Mike? Are you going to keep doing it for as long as you can? Or do you think you'll have had your fun at some point?
I've definitely had my fun. We've just made this amazing series, which is called Wheeler Dealers World Tour, which I'm really excited about. It starts this month.
Great.
So I'm very excited about that in the month of April. I've got to make Wheeler Dealers all over the world. You know, I did we did Wheeler Dealers for 13 years, and then I did Wheeler Dealers Trading Up, where I went all over the world buying and selling cars on every continent. I did that twice, two laps around the planet. Then Wheeler Dealers moved to America, and I made it in Hollywood for 6 years. You know, right? These two upstart Burks from England arrive in Hollywood and get to make a show in Hollywood. You know, and then after that, Ed left and Ant come to join me again, still in Hollywood, and now he's, you know, hooked up with a Hollywood star.
Yeah.
So this little weeny show, you know, it spreads, it's international, and it spread itself around the planet. And it's been so successful that I said to Discovery Channel, I need to do something for the audience. You know, we need to do something exciting for the audience. So I started to write down a world tour. Where would we take the show to put it back in the hands of the people that love it around the planet? And they said yes. So we've just made this amazing world tour, which I'm still finishing off at the moment, just doing the last tidy bits. And I can't wait for the audience to see it. And we're talking about, so to answer your question, where's it going? We are talking about world tour, so to continue Blimey. That world tour. And we've written another 20 episodes.
Oh, wow. Blimey. Gosh, there's a lot to come then. God.
So, well, let's hope so. Great. Whether they can afford me or not.
Has it ever gone completely wrong? Have you ever sort of bought a car which has turned out not to be what you thought it was going to be? Complete basket pace. Everybody loses their shirt. And when that happens, I think I've probably over the years seen most of them. I can't remember you ever coming out of one saying, well, that's just cost us a packet. Wish I'd never bought it. I mean, if something like that happened to you, would the show not go out? Or have you had disasters which you've owned up to?
Well, I'm pretty good at buying cars,
sure,
and knowing what to do. So I've kind of avoided that, believe it or not. Yes, of course, there's been a few disasters along the way, of which you know, some of it's made screens, some of it hasn't. We've never given up on a car, so we've never bought a car and it's and we've given up on it. There was a Volvo 480 ES that we bought 2 years ago to put in one of the series. And we just never got round to it. It got parked at the back. And we never ever got round to it because other cars stepped in and were better stories. And so we'd given up on that. We did have the one car, I think, that both me and Ed always, whenever anyone asks us this question, me and Ed had one car, which was that awful Chevy 260. It was badged up a Bel Air. I don't know if you remember that, the yellow one. We painted it yellow at the end. It looked like a checker cab. That vehicle, although American cars of the 1950s are two socket sizes and one flathead screwdriver, and you can pull them apart.
Yeah.
That car, it was almost like having Mike Tyson in the workshop. It put gloves on and it had a fight. It just fought us every step of the way. And every single thing on that car was impossible. It didn't want to be restored. It was, don't touch me. I don't want to be restored. I want to go. I want to die. But we fought it along the way, and it bruised knuckles, ripped clothes. It caught fire. Everything went wrong with this car. And every single thing we bought for it didn't fit. Nothing could fit back on the car. But we wrestled it. We wrestled that car and we won. You know, we won and put it back out there in the marketplace, and it's still being enjoyed today. But yeah, I mean, they are, that's a disaster story, that car. I don't know if Ed's ever told this story. I'm sure he has. There was also the Dodge Charger, the black one.
Wow.
I remember when that car arrived at the workshop. It was lovely, that car.
So this was like a Dukes of Hazzard Charger, late 60s?
Yeah, 1969, I do believe. Big black Dodge Charger I bought in Texas.
Wow.
Mega. And when it came back to the workshop, it was on the low loader. And I think Ed, I think he'll tell you this, I think he undone the strap rather exuberantly and it rolled off the trailer and straight into a wall and smashed it up. Although it was lovely when I bought it, I think we smashed up the front of it, so we had to sort of disguise that on screen until we got the parts.
Right, okay. So just how long does it usually take for, you know, from a car, you go and buy a car, and then it goes through the whole process, and then you set it on again. Are we talking a matter of a few weeks, a few months? Is there any sort of, you know, typical period of time that it takes for this to happen?
Well, when we tell people this, they think we're making it up. But it comes down to how much money we've got in terms of a budget. So when you're putting these shows together, you're given a certain amount of budget and a certain amount of time to turn these shows around. And it, in the early days with Ed, it used to be, I think we had 13 days basically to for each show. But that 13 days wouldn't be a continuous 13 days. It would be one day to buy the car, one day to get it to Ed to hand it over and for Ed to do his opening piece to camera, 2 days in the workshop, then it would disappear and get painted somewhere. Then it would come back and it'd be another 2 days in the workshop. So overall, it would be about 13 days of screen time, if you like. We're now down to, I think we're down to 6 days or 7 days at the moment. So when I tell people we restore a car, sometimes a nut and bolt restoration like we did on the Fiesta recently, restore a car, we literally do it in 7 days. We turn these cars around. But as I say, it'd be 7 days spread over a 2 or 3 week period.
And do you have a few going at once, or are they in sequence one after another?
No, there's usually about four on the go at once.
Yeah.
3 or 4 on the go at once.
So
it's quite a puzzle, to be honest.
I'm sure.
So presumably it's not just Ed or Ant or Elvis working on. Presumably there are other mechanics who you don't get seen who are helping out behind the scenes, because you'd never be able to do it otherwise, would you?
No, exactly. I think you met Paul in the early days. That was Ed's on-screen and off-screen mechanic. We had Paul. We ended up in the Ed years, I think we had 5 extra mechanics working behind the scenes. And that would be for the stuff that you don't see on screen. So I'll explain this. So if you're going to see Ed or Ant or Elvis, they're going to change a front upright on a car. So they're going to take the disc, the hub, the pads. They're going to remove all of that. They're going to remove the suspension strut, the suspension arm, change the lower wishbone, build it all back up again. Presto, that's your item on screen. You don't need to see the other side. Nobody needs to see the guys do the other side, because it's boring. You've seen it on one side. You don't need to see them do the other side. So that's what these mechanics are for. You'd see the stuff on screen, and then the other side off screen would just get done. Mm. Elvis has, Ant had, I think, 3 extra mechanics, and Elvis has 2. One of them's almost permanent. He's called Will Trickett from another Wheeler Dealer clone car show, which is called Flipping Bangers.
Yep.
And Will is astonishingly good, amazing, a real real mechanic. He knows absolutely everything. And then we have another mechanic. I think we've got 2 other mechanics, but they don't do every day. They do a couple of days a week. And Elvis does the majority of it. I mean, Elvis just loves working on the cars. You can't stop him. He's quite. And not only that, a lot of people, you know, I get called out online saying, you know, I don't do anything, you lazy sod, and, you know, mechanics all the work. But what they don't know is that when the cameras are cut, of course, I'm in on the cars as well. Sometimes even the sound recorders and cameramen, you know, they put their tools down and they jump on the tools, and we help, all of us together, we help put the cars together, and we work hard at it.
How has the the show evolved over the years, Mike? You said that when you started, it was a bloke with a camera, a little camera, and a tiny crew. I assume it's sort of grown and evolved over the years.
It has, yeah. I mean, when we first started, I think we had 5 or 6 people in production.
Wow.
When we was in Hollywood, we had 47
Whoa.
People.
Whoa. Blimey.
So it grew to quite a size. Yeah. I am really pleased to say, though, and this shows you the mark of Wheeler Dealers and its friendship, because it is a friendship circle. I've still got the same cameraman, John and Nick, and the same sound recorder, Simon, I've had for 20 years.
Wow.
They're the same group. They joined and nobody ever leaves.
Yeah.
And the team that I'm working with at the moment, Steve and Anthony, they've been with, and Elvis, they've been with me for 5 years.
Mm.
And they've never left. You know, they joined and they went, this is the best thing ever. We're never leaving. So that shows you just what it feels like to go to work in the morning. You go to work with your work colleagues. It feels like family. And yes, of course, it's grown. Camera equipment's got better. At one point, the budget's got really good. So we did have, tracking inside the workshop where they lay a dolly down and do all these fancy Hollywood shots. But today, the budgets are a little bit more slender, so we're having to be a bit more creative. But we still deliver, I think, a world-class show.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah. And I think you've sort of allowed the budget for the car that you're buying to grow over the years, haven't you? I think to begin with, you were spending hundreds.
Yeah, so it was originally called Grand Autos, Wheeler Dealers. And it was buy cars and fix them up for a grand.
Wow.
That was the working title, which was quickly changed to Wheeler Dealers. I had a company called Wheeler. I still got a company called Wheeler Dealer. And they see that on a footnote of an email and went, oh, that's a great name. Mm. We'll ask Mike if we can use his title instead. So that's why it became Wheeler Dealers. And over the years, it's grown. You know, it's grown into this phenomenon. I forget what was the question again.
So you were spending up to a grand initially.
Oh, right, yeah, up to a grand, and then that's grown over the years to become, because I wanted a feature iconic cars,
yeah.
But I wanted to keep within the realms of normal people. You know, there was already this very successful other show on the TV with Clarkson, Hammond and May, where they would be driving Lamborghinis Ferraris. Yeah. And that's your aspirational cars. And I was thinking, well, we're never going to be that. So let us be the aspirational cars, but for the everyman. So, you know, your Sierra Cosworth or Escort Cosworth or Golf GTI, 205 GTI. So that's where I wanted to position the show and focus the show. So they're aspirational, but affordable. On this last series, the World Tour, it's the first time in 20 years we sort of thrown it out with the bathwater. So the first time in 20 years, I said to Discovery Warner that if we're going to go out to the world, we need to focus on the cars that move a nation. So the cars that, rather than the cars that I want to turn up in Germany and buy an E-Class Mercedes, that's boring. What is the car in Germany that the Germans just go crazy for? And it's the car that they're very proud of. And of course, it's an M car, and the mass M car that was for us was the E30 M3. Wow. But to buy one of those, you're talking 60, 70 grand these days. So I've had to tell Discovery Warner, don't panic. We're going to buy a 60 grand car, but don't panic. I'll sell it for 65 or I'll sell it for 75. You know, don't panic. It's all relative.
Yeah.
But at least we can tell the story of the M car, Germany, social history and why it's important to them. And that's what we've been focusing on.
So have you ever done, I mean, I was watching one recently where you did a V12 E-Type.
Yeah.
Is that about as sort of far up market as you've got? Have you ever done an Italian exotic?
Yeah, we've done quite a few. We've done a Ferrari. Me and Ed did a 208 back in the day. And
208? Blimey.
Yeah, on this new series of Wheeler Dealers. We've just done a 348 in Maranello. So we went to Italy. What's the car that emotes Italians?
Yeah.
It's their church where they go and pray at the weekend. So we've done the last analog Ferrari, the 348. You'll be pleased to know, Andrew, when we went to France, there was only one car you can feature, a car that's been featured on Wheeler Dealers before. but I wanted to focus on what's got France moving in post-war austerity, and what are they so proud of that they are just going to burst at the seams to tell the story? And it was the Fourgonette. So we've just featured a wonderful 2CV Fourgonette. in the French episode. And in Poland, really interesting one in Poland, because the Polish do have a national car, which is the Serena or the Warsaw. But the car that they love and take to heart isn't Polish. It's a Fiat. It's a little 126.
Yeah,
which was built in Poland.
It was built in Poland, yeah. As a Polonaise, as a 126P. So we've gone out to Poland and featured one of those. And it's been fascinating, you know, to tell that social history with these cars. And of course, that means that, you know, some cars are relatively cheap. You know, I'm buying cars for $3,000, $4,000 in Poland. Mm. But when I'm in Italy, to buy a 348 these days, you've got to spend $50,000, $55,000,
yeah,
for a decent one, an E30 M3. That was 60, up to $60,000. So, I'm throwing the budgets out with the bathwater,
yeah,
and just going for what the story is the best one to tell.
I was watching an episode the other day. You were restoring a very old Transit van.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, you said something along the lines of, this is the best thing we've ever done on this show. This is my favourite car.
Yeah.
Does that still hold? And can you talk us why that particular, I'd better say a car, it wasn't a car, it was a vehicle, why that connected with you in a way that nothing else did?
It's just so weird, this one. So much so, Andrew, I own it, that Transit. Yeah. So much so. So when I was a kid, I can remember being, you know, 10 years of age, sitting beside my dad. He was a delivery driver before he was a car customizer. He was a delivery driver in London, and my school holidays were spent beside my dad, and he would be bombing around London delivering record sleeves. He worked in the record industry, and he'd deliver. And I would sit beside him, and I would change gear in that Transit van. That was my. I would grab that Mark One Transit gear knob.
Yeah.
He would let me. Sometimes we would. He would even show me how to change gear without using the clutch, just to rev match it. And I'd change gear for him, and it was the best thing ever. Jumping in a van with my dad at work in the summer, and I was half a van driver.
Yeah.
You know, there I am changing gear for my dad, or turning the indicator on or off, or, you know, whatever it was. And it fast forward almost, you know, 50 years.
Yeah.
And I stumble upon this 1974 Mark One long wheelbase twin wheel Transit. And the moment, cars are time machines. I've always said this to people. They're amazing time machines. The moment I jumped in that Transit and touched the gear knob, it flashed. My brain just flashed back to those happy memories I had with my dad bombing around London, grabbing hold of this gear knob and changing gear. And there's something remarkable about a Transit, an early Mark One or a Mark II Transit. You sit on top of them, so you're sitting above everything. And it was sort of one of the first vehicles that done that. They handle like a Cortina.
Yeah.
So they handle like a road car. They rev fantastically. They're light over the rear wheels, and they just make you feel bloody alive. They're so exciting to drive. And it's a van. Yeah. It's a van. And that's why bank robbers loved them and the police loved them back in the day. So when I found that this left-hand drive Mark One Transit, remember being left-hand drive, I was also holding the gear knob in the right hand.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
just like I was when I was a kid. So, of course, you know, we had to restore it. I had to buy it. We had to restore it. And at the end, we took it to Grimsby and had the police chase us in a Mark One Escort.
I remember.
Crashing through cardboard boxes. Yeah. And I'm going to tell you, and you can ask Elvis, it's probably the best ever day I had on Wheel of Dealers up until that point. And there we are, just bombing around in a Mark One Transit. It was so much fun. Wow. It was so much fun. That after the show, I sold it to two guys that own a van centre for a display vehicle. And I sold it to them, and they couldn't wait to buy it. So that ended up in their van centre. 6 months later, I asked them if I could borrow it to take to the NEC and put it on display at the NEC. And once I got back in it 6 months later and took it to the NEC, there was no way they were going to get it back. So I asked them, you know, they got to sell it to me. I don't care what they want for it. I don't care how much I've got to pay for it. I've got to have it. So I bought it back.
Fantastic.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Before we move on and talk about your car dealer days, Mike, and maybe a little bit of buying advice,
yeah,
Andrew, can we talk about your cameo on Wheeler Dealers.
Oh yeah,
Dealers,
like cameo, starring
role. Sorry,
probably the finest starring episode they've ever broadcast.
I remember the day very well.
Do you?
I do, Andrew, very fondly. I remember that day because we'd known each other for years. We've been on many a car launch together.
And I had to pretend I'd never met you before in my life.
Yes, but what was really funny is I think on that day, if you remember rightly, you'd just driven a McLaren P1.
Oh, God, I had.
And you were more excited about coming to drive this crappy old 2CV than a McLaren P1.
I'd completely forgotten. But I'd driven it down at Dunsfold. And did I just come from there to you on the way home?
Come from there to me, yes. You went, I've been driving this McLaren P1 all day, but I'm more excited about it behind the wheel of this.
Yes.
Yeah, so you found that car. I mean, can you remember bits about everything that's ever been on the show?
Yeah, I found that car. Bits about everything. You know? Yeah. I remember finding a car in Saint-Moritz in the south of France and buying it off this little French garage and the guy that we bought it off. And there's something about, you know, when I'm buying cars, it's not only the car that you're buying, it's the person you're buying it from that can tell the story of a car. And there was something absolutely wonderful about that whole 2CV experience because it was an early one. It looked right. It felt right. It drove right. And it was one of those cars. It wasn't the Mike Tyson. This was one of those cars that was screaming out for Mike Brewer to come and find it. Hmm. Please come and find me. I want to be restored. I want to be rescued. And of course, being it's a 2CV, it's very, very simple. You know, things come apart easy. Things unhook off the car, like the seats, you just unhook them. You know, there's no nuts and bolts. And so it's really easy to restore. And in that case, that meant that we could do a full restoration on that car. And I was absolutely delighted. I can remember one of the processes I did was the roof and just how lovely and wonderful and simple it was to put that wonderful roof back on. And what an amazing little journey. And then to end that journey with, I get a phone call from Andrew Frankel saying, I want to buy the 2CV. I'm like, Andrew from the Times newspaper?
As was, yeah. Oh,
well, are kidding me.
And you still got it. And you still love it.
Yeah, not only do I still have it, I'll never sell it. It's honestly, it's a joy. And the only thing I've done to it, you might regard this as a heresy, but when I got it, I had it for a couple of years, but 12 horsepower was just, I was struggling with 12 horsepower.
You live in a hilly part of the country.
And I thought what I'll do is I put a sort of modern, so it's got a 425cc engine. I thought I'll put a 602 in it, but you can't do it without cutting the car up because it just doesn't fit. But somebody told me that there was an engine they did, I think for like a 2CV van from the mid 60s, because mine's a late 50s car, which has got 18 horsepower. So I've got one of those in it now. And the original engine is preserved in Aspic. If I ever sell the car, which I won't, it'll go with it. But 18 horsepower is the difference between cruising at 50 and cruising at 40. And that's actually a big, big difference.
Yeah.
So is it now your GTI version?
Oh, absolutely.
2CV GTI.
But honestly, Mike, that car is, I think I said somewhere that it is impossible to be unhappy in driving that car at the same time, because it is just a delight. And you guys did for anybody who ever thinks that, you know, you just sort of patch stuff up and chuck it out. You did Ed did such a beautiful job on that car. It was beautiful, fantastic. Yeah, and I'm incredibly grateful to you guys because, you know, it has been a constant part of making me happy over the last decade, and I'm sure for as long as I'm spared, we'll continue to do so.
And that's something about cars, isn't it, Andrew? You just hit the nail on the head there when you said it just makes you happy being in and around that car. I always think with a car like a 2CV or a Mark 1 Mini or recently I've had that little Suzuki Jimny, the new one, the little Suzuki Jimny.
Yeah.
And there is something about those cars that when you park them up and you walk back to your house, if you had a Ferrari, you turn around and look at it because it's beautiful. But there's something about that 2CV or a Mark 1 Mini or the Transit van or, as I say, recently a Jimny. It's like you jump out, you look back at it and you go, that was just ridiculous. That was so much fun, and it put such a smile on my face. That just make me happy. So I love cars that do that. And yeah, the 2CV definitely does.
Brilliant.
This now seems like a daft question because we can see how much you love the show, how much you enjoy doing it. But thinking back to your car dealer days, before anyone pointed a television camera at you, is there a small part of you that sort of pines for those days where you earn a living just selling cars and the characters and the stories and the adventures?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I still do it today, not to the same level. Back in 1996, I was working in South London with my wife, Michelle. You know, we've been together forever, and me and Michelle were working on the car site together, and we had our little tips and tricks to get our car sold between us. And I loved those days. It was freedom as well. You know, I was a very, very good car dealer. Mm. I've been in and around cars all my life, being my dad was a very famous customizer. And by the time I got to my teenage years, I knew cars were going to be my life. I stepped into the motor trade early on. My first week in the motor trade, I sold 11 cars. Somebody gave me £1,100 at the end of a week. Mm. This is way back in the 80s.
Wow.
And when you got given £1,100 at the end of a week, you said, I'm never going to do anything else ever in my life. I wouldn't even be an astronaut. This is the best money I've ever earned. And I've become a really good car dealer. And yes, of course, I pine for the days of that freedom that enables you to buy something that you know that you can make a profit out of. But what I like about it most, and I still do today, is that in some respects, yes, it's a commercial business. You buy a car, you fix it up, you sell it. But a lot of the times you overlook the fact that you are also changing people's lives and making dreams come true.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple of instances recently where somebody's bought a vehicle off of me, and after the deal is done, they punch the air with delight. They've got the car that they want. That's an amazing feeling, incredible feeling.
So let's see if we can squeeze a little bit of car buying advice out of Mike, shall we, Andrew?
Yeah.
I mean, just imagine how much knowledge and expertise is in that head of his.
Up there. I've got some.
So how do we do this?
Well,
Andrew?
I mean, I guess one question. I mean, people are, and I think understandably, apprehensive of the whole secondhand car buying process, because, you know, for every Mike Brewer out there, there might be somebody else who is less reputable, you know, and just keen on turnover and will sell anybody anything if they think they can get the money for it. How justified is that reputation? How should people ensure they buy the right car from the right person? Are there any sort of set rules that people should observe in this process?
Yes, Andrew. These days it's much, much easier. So gone are the days where, you know, really, I think you don't see people selling cars under railway arches anymore, or, you know, just mark them up quick and get them out the door and they're gone a week later. I don't think that exists anymore, because these days people, they don't go and buy a cup of coffee without reviewing the cafe that they're going to get a cup of coffee from. Yeah. So the review process is really vital and very important to the car industry. So if you're going to go and buy a car from a dealer, review it. You know, go and look at their reviews online and see what their experience is like. Also, the car that you're buying, no doubt, you're looking at a car on the internet that's advertised on a car dealer's forecourt. You can see the registration number. You can easily do a data check yourself just from your computer at home without shifting your ass off the chair. And you can find out a whole heap about a car's past and history before you even contact the dealer. So when you do contact the dealer, you are informed. You know exactly what to talk to them about. You know what the car's histories should be like. And all the dealer should be there for is to service your needs. It shouldn't be there to force you into buying a car. You should already know before you get there the car that you want to buy. Also, you'd be amazed the amount of people that still make the mistake of coming to buy a car that don't think about what purpose they're going to use the car for.
Yeah.
I had somebody last week come buy a van off of me, because we sell vans as well, because he's got a motocross bike and he wants to go motocrossing. So he comes and buys this van, you know, £27,000-£28,000 van. But the motocross bike won't even fit in the back. It's so big, it won't fit in the back of the van. So you buy a car for the purpose that you need it for. Mm. If you're going to buy a car to go shopping and you want it to as a shopping vehicle, make sure that when you go on a test drive, go and park in the supermarket car parks if it fits. Mm. You know, where I live in Warwickshire. It's Land Rover country round here because we've got Gaydon down the road. If you go to any supermarket around here, pull into Sainsbury's car park, it's full of Range Rovers and Discoveries and people car and Defenders. And they're huge, massive, great big vehicles. And if you park two of them and try and squeeze a modern Mini in between them, you're not getting out your car. It won't. You won't be able to get out of it. So you have to think about the purpose you're using your car for as well. And does it suit that purpose? If you're going to garage your car, make sure you take it home and see if it fits in the garage. Modern cars don't fit in a garage from a house that was built in the 1950s or 1960s. They simply don't fit. So you want to make sure that the vehicle you're buying is set for the purpose that you're buying it for. But as I say, you can do loads of checks before you even lift your bum off the chair to go and see it. And be informed, you know, be informed. I always say to people, fill your library before you fill your garage. Be informed before you get to the dealer.
Clever.
Okay, next question. How do you haggle? How do you haggle with Mike Brewer? What level should you go in at? What is the right sort of level without insulting the person trying to sell you the car, but, you know, likely to get you the best outcome? And how hard should you push?
Okay, well, you push as hard as the other car that's for sale. So if you're, and this is a thing that happens on a daily basis with me, if they're, because I'm buying cars all the time, if there's a vehicle for sale in, let's take, for instance, a standard vehicle, let's go for an Audi A4. There's one for sale that's in Birmingham that's done 26,000 miles and it's for sale for £8,200. But you're staring at a car that's in London that's a Audi A4 with 26,000 miles, identical car, there'd be loads of them out there, and it's £8,100. Then you can haggle with the dealer and say, can I get the car for 1,800? And they're like, they say, no, why should I? So, because I can go and buy this other one for £100 cheaper.
Yeah.
And it's the same car, it's just £100 cheaper. And I'll go and buy that one if you don't let me have this one. And dealers will inevitably bend because they will know that these days, in terms of what you can look up on the internet, you can walk into a dealership armed with all this information before you get there. So you know that the car that you're targeting at a dealer, you can go and buy cheaper elsewhere, walk into your dealer, tell them you can buy it cheaper elsewhere, and they will fold. They will let you have the car.
But generally speaking, what's the sort of, what's the difference between a price that a dealer asks for a car and a price that the dealer will sell the car? Is it like a 10% gap? So if you went in 10% what they were below what they were asking for it, is that a reasonable thing to aim for?
No, not at all. The margins on used car selling today are much, much tighter than they ever were. And that's because of all the tools out there and the things that we've been discussing that the audience can do. Also, most of the used car trade is owned and run, if you like, in terms of its pricing by Auto Trader. So Auto Trader will tell a dealer what they should be paying for a car. They'll also tell a dealer what is the recommended retail price because of all the others that are out there at that retail price. So the dealer margins these days has squished down. It's become very, very aggressive and quite tight. And dealers will know instantaneously whether it's working or not, because on the dealer's portal from Auto Trader, when they advertise their car, it's a traffic light system, green, amber, red. And if nobody's clicked on your advert would just be red all the time on your portal. If it's amber, that means that there's people clicking and they're interested, but nobody's committing. But if it's green, that means you're getting a load of inquiries on that car and it will shift off your forecourt. So dealers out there are all trying to find the greens. They're all trying to find the green cars, the cars that are going to that are gonna sell quickly. And that means that the margins are much tighter.
Mm. Cars that have been involved in small accidents, and I don't know the new categories. I used to understand the old categories, but they've all changed. But if a car's sustained reasonably light accident damage, is that a bargain or a car to avoid?
Well, I've always said in the past, you should know your onions before you peel them. And it's a weird saying, but it's, I've avoided written off cars. Cars that have been totally written off, I've avoided my whole life. However, there is this huge movement online with YouTubers where they're buying written-off supercars and they're fixing them up and making shows out of them and earning fortunes out of making these shows on YouTube. And it sort of changed my perception of what is a written-off car and whether it's right to put that car back on the road. Me personally, I would think if a car was written off because it caused death or it, you know, run a child over, or I don't think that car should be back on the road.
No, sure.
I don't think that people want to see that registration plate on the road again. However, there are bargains to be had. You can buy a car that's had a light tap or a knock from an insurance company, or an auction that's claimed that it's had a light tap and it is repairable and it can be put back on the road. I would just do my due diligence and find out what happened in the accident. Mm. Did somebody die? You know, did a kid get run over? If so, I'd walk away.
Mm. We are quickly running out of time, Mike, but we can't finish this podcast without talking to you a little bit about your cars. What are you knocking about Warwickshire in most days?
Well, I'm a Porsche man, so I do like my Porsches. I've got a wonderful Ford Ranger Raptor, which is my everyday car, which is the big, roughy-tufty off-roader, which you need in the countryside. But most days you'll find me, if I want a bit of excitement, I'll jump into one of my Porsches.
Are these air-cooled Porsches, older ones?
I've got a little collection. So I've got everything from a 1968 911 2.2T to a 1991 3.3 turbo 964.
Oh wow.
Is that the car that just before we came on air you were saying that you were having a sort of restoration project on? Is that the car that you're working on at the moment?
It is, yeah. So I'm, you know,
scary car, 3.3 964 3.3 turbos. I've almost had an enormous accident in one of them.
They are terrifying. This car wants to kill me every time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just wants to end my life. That's what makes it so exciting. I remember walking into a car show 7 years ago in California when I lived there, and standing in front of the DSL lightweight study from Singer. And I walked into a car show and it was put on a stand, and I was like a kid at a toy shop. You left me there, stood in front of that car, and you could have walked off for 10 hours, come back, and I was still standing there staring at it. And that's basically what happened. I just never left that car all day. And I was fascinated by it. The whole experience of being around that car was incredible. And I swore to myself, I'm going to do that. I'm going to buy one and I'm going to do it myself. Because Singer charge ridiculous prices and you have to wait a few years to get your car back. So I thought, well, just car restoration. I've made a sort of career out of doing car flips and car restoration. I'm pretty sure I can do it myself. So I've been trying to find and target the right car to do it with, and I found a free turbo 964. And my next project is going to be making my own version of a Singer, a bringer, if you like. I might steal that. Put
not
it on
a minger.
There.
Not a minger, no.
In the correct script, you know, the brewer bringer. Because I want that. That's the only car I think I'll need. You know, I think that's the best.
Yeah,
it's gorgeous, and it's probably the only sort of classic car. All the others will, you know, fall by the wayside. I'm disposing of the others to just make space for this one car because I just want it so desperately.
Mm. Oh, fantastic. Mike, it's been a total
pleasure
having you on. Hearing about Wheeler Dealers, it's a phenomenal show. The success has been extraordinary. And, well, it's all deserved as well.
Long may it last.
And long may it last, yeah. So,
well, thank you, guys. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Mike. Maybe we'll do it again at some point.
I'd love to. Yeah, I've only told a little bit of the story. There's so much more to go.
All right, we'll do it again. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Mike. All the best.
Thank you. All the best.